AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
From the hometown of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM, your news talk and sports station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by General Steel.
I'm Stacey Lynn in Washington. Some really weird weather in California. Here's CBS's Steve Futterman.
This hasn't happened here in the Los Angeles area since 1989. Blizzard warnings are in effect, and some places are actually seeing snow.
How often does it snow in Southern California?
Unusually cold temperatures at low elevations are what's turning rain into snow, and these same conditions are expected to continue throughout the weekend.
Some not-so-good news about a reservoir in northern Arizona that supplies water to states in the West. Here's CBS's Stefan Kaufman.
Lake Powell is now seeing its lowest water level since the mid-1960s because of the region's continuing drought. Colorado State University water scientist Brad Udall.
The lake is down 75% from when it was nearly full in the year 2000. So we have a quarter of this lake upon which 40 million Americans depend still left.
As the Russian war in Ukraine enters its second year.
According to the United Nations, about 19,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed or injured. But officials acknowledge that the real figure is likely much higher. American and British military officials estimate 200,000 Russian troops have been killed or wounded.
That's CBS's Dana Jacobson. Two Pakistanis have been released from Guantanamo Bay. Here's CBS's Linda Kenyon.
The Pentagon says the two were never charged with any crimes during their 20 years in U.S. custody. Their return to Pakistan leaves 32 detainees at Gitmo, which once held hundreds of prisoners.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy handed over a bunch of surveillance and police videos from the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He handed them to Fox News host Tucker Carlson. Capitol Hill correspondent Scott McFarlane says there's a big security concern, that the House Democrats are now looking into.
There are two big unknowns. Was anybody chaperoning this Fox News team as they watched all this video? Did they log in or log out? And were they able to record any of it while they were viewing it?
New legislation is being proposed in Austin, Texas, that would ban nearly all gender-affirming care. Robert Salcido is with Pride San Antonio.
It's a bill that is meant to harm and to stifle the LGBTQ+ community, specifically trans folks, as a way to erase them.
And maybe skip the healthy salad today. Grab a cheeseburger instead. Dole was hit with a massive ransomware attack earlier this month that temporarily shut down production plants all across North America. So less of those salad mixes got shipped to grocery stores across the country. That's why you're not seeing as many on store shelves. This is CBS News.
Business owners, General Steel can help save you thousands by owning your own custom-designed buildings. Call 888-98-STEEL or visit generalsteel.com.
If you have unfiled taxes or are in debt to the IRS, this is important news. The IRS just rolled out a new program to help struggling taxpayers more easily resolve their tax problems. It's called the Taxpayer Relief Initiative, and it opens up powerful new options for people looking to get back on the right track with the IRS. And no one knows this program like the professionals at Optima Tax Relief, America's most trusted tax resolution company. They've resolved over $1 billion in tax debt for their clients and have the expertise and experience to help you. One easy call to Optima can start the process, helping to put an end to your worries of wage garnishment, asset seizure, and other aggressive IRS actions. Make today the beginning of your fresh start with the IRS. Call the experts at Optima Tax Relief now for your free confidential consultation.
Call 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
Jonas using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
Jammers Bar & Grill is looking to add to their team. Jammers Bar & Grill has openings for bartenders. They're excited to bring someone new to the Jammers team and are offering good wages with great tips and a friendly atmosphere. Yes, they'd like a little experience, but they're also open to training. Stop into Jammers today to pick up an application and meet some of the team. Jammers Bar and Grill, 2810 Eagle Road, Wisconsin Rapids.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR.
Partly cloudy skies this afternoon with daytime highs approaching 30. Southwesterly winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Partly cloudy skies again tonight. Lows dip down to about 12. Mainly sunny skies and calm tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 34. About an inch of snow Monday through Monday night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 18.
Stop surfing the dial. You've found the greatest station ever. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Glenn's Choice for News Talk Radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Morning Cannolis with James Centel is an independent product and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
It is Saturday, February 25th, 2023. For those of us continuing from our first hour, those of us who are joining us for the first time in this hour, we're spending our morning today talking all about the United States Supreme Court and some major decisions made by the court in connection with decisions rendered, rulings, opinions issued, also some decisions made about cases it's going to hear. And then we're going to spend a lot of time in this hour talking about some very important oral arguments of Tuesday and Wednesday of this past week that quite literally affect the future of the internet and the possibility of the imposition of civil liability for internet providers when users of those platforms post things, messages, information items, misinformation items that may result in horrific consequences. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Thank you once again for joining me and my wonderful producer, Calvin. We're here at the studios of WAUK Radio in Waukesha, always taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. As we continue our focus on what happened, why is it important, and what to do about it this week, next week, and the week after that, focusing on rulings, decisions, actions of the United States Supreme Court. In our final moments of the first hour, we were talking about this all-important case decided by the Supreme Court on February 22nd, just this past week, involving an inmate who is facing the death penalty imposed upon him by a jury in Arizona that was not told that if they, in fact, voted for a life sentence, he would not be eligible for parole. Now, why is that significant? Well, we know that in the wake of the imposition of this death penalty upon John Montenegro Cruz for what is admittedly the horrific murder of a Tucson police officer way back in 2003, nobody is disputing the fact that he needs to face justice and should either be in prison for the rest of his life or face the death penalty. The question is due process, appropriate application of the laws and the rule of law in Arizona and in our federal courts, even for those who have committed these kinds of heinous crimes, everyone entitled to justice, as five members of our Supreme Court this past week determined. Those five members, once again, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, joining with the other three, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, defined that the Arizona court, the Arizona judge, that had failed to advise the jury of this option, that is to impose a life sentence that would not carry with it the eligibility parole, that the failure to do that resulted in a violation of Mr. Cruz's rights. And so we know that following the recommendation of this death sentence by a jury, what happened? Three jurors issued a statement saying that they had made what's called a gut-wrenching decision, their words, not mine, and that, quote, there was not one person on the jury who did not cry. They said that they would have voted for life had they known that there was no possibility of parole. A fourth juror later on made a same statement. In other words, convinced that this man, Mr. Cruz, should never ever see the light of day, but nonetheless probably inclined to impose a life sentence if they knew that he would not see the light of day, would not be subject to parole, not advised of that. So they presumed that if they imposed a life sentence, he might be released someday. And that's what they did not want to accomplish, not advised that that would not happen, and instead voted for the death penalty. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, writing for the majority, said Arizona got it wrong. The judge needed to instruct the jury about this aspect of their decision-making process. And she said that Cruz's case was a rare one in which the Supreme Court should, in fact, second-guess a state court's interpretation of a state law. It's a little bit more complicated than I'm even describing right now. It has to do with the implication of state law and some Supreme Court justice decisions involving a case called Lynch versus Arizona. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor went on to say this past week that Lynch overruled binding Arizona precedent. Before Lynch, Arizona courts held that capital defendants were not entitled to inform the jury of their parole ineligibility. Lots of double negatives there. I have to follow along very, very closely. But after Lynch, after this major decision, again, this according to Sonia Sotomayor, writing for the majority, the decision of the Supreme Court, after Lynch, Arizona courts recognized that capital defendants have, here it comes, a due process right to provide the jury with that information when future dangerousness is at issue. It is hard to imagine a clearer break from the past. And again, five members of the Supreme Court siding in favor of the defendant, sending this back down for resentencing, in which the jury will be told that, in fact, he would be ineligible for parole if they vote for a life sentence. Significantly, Justice Amy Coney Barrett joins Justices Clarence Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch in dissenting. The court makes a case, she said, for a case why the Arizona Supreme Court's interpretation of its own precedent is wrong. She says, if I were on the Supreme Court, I might agree, but that call is not within our bailiwick, says we shouldn't be playing around with this at all. And so they dissent, but not enough votes to overcome the majority decision. Cruz versus Arizona, a major capital case, a major case for rule of law and the imposition of justice in America just this past week by our United States Supreme Court. More of those coming up plainly in May, in June, maybe even in July as well. And so let us turn now, finally, in this second hour of our broadcast, talking all about things Supreme Court related, to talk about two major oral arguments conducted by all the justices in Washington, D.C., at the Supreme Court building, a building that was built and opened in 1935. Ever since then, convening at that location. Yes, it's now open once again post-COVID. You can go and you can listen in. You can visually see the justices. You can wait in line and watch as they hear these oral arguments, which they're doing routinely now. Still can't tour the building. That may happen at some point down the road. Significantly also, by way of public service here, I'll also indicate that these oral arguments, that is, these opportunities for the justices to question the parties about their positions, they're not making decisions. They're simply engaging in questions and answers, comments back and forth, as you will hear in just a few moments, about the merits and demerits of the cases before them. Those oral arguments are continuing, many of them already conducted, as we talked about, in the fall of this past year, resuming now, once again, in early 2023, anticipating that decisions like the one in Cruz will be coming forth in the coming months, especially, again, May, June, maybe July. This past week, Tuesday and Wednesday, again, when other focuses of our nation were grabbing the headlines, the Supreme Court entertained oral argument in two major cases that quite literally could impact the future viability of what we know as the internet and social media platforms. Let's talk about these two cases. They're called Gonzalez versus Google. Yes, that Google. And Twitter. Yes, that Twitter versus Tamne, T-A-A-M-N-E-H. Let me tell you about both of them. They're somewhat related, but they come about in slightly different ways. They invoke slightly different statutory codifications. Let's begin with the first one of them. We've spoken about this a little bit in the past. Noemi Gonzalez, she was a 23-year-old college student from California. She was studying abroad in Paris in November of 2015. You may remember the events of that time. They commanded worldwide attention. She was among the 130 people killed in a coordinated series of terrorist attacks. Recall this, throughout the city of Paris, riveting. 130 people killed in these terrorist attacks. She was a first-generation college student. She was studying there design. She was studying design there in Paris at the California State University location, coming out of Long Beach. She was killed while she was out with friends during this Paris attack in 2015. And significantly, the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, we sort of know them as by both of those monikers, both of those acronyms, later claimed responsibility for these horrific attacks in Paris in 2015. She was the only American that was killed in those attacks. The next year, her father sued Google. On what basis? Sued Google and some other tech companies on what basis? He specifically accused the firms of spreading content on that platform, the Google platform, that radicalized users into becoming terrorists. And as a part of his complaint in this country, said that, therefore, Google was legally responsible for the harm that was inflicted on the Gonzalez family as a result of Noemi's death. Her mother, stepfather, brothers eventually joined that lawsuit as well. The claims were, in fact, heard by the United States Supreme Court after coming up from lower courts just this past Tuesday. And their lawsuit, Google, now the exclusive defendant in these cases, could have a seismic, quite dramatic ramifications on the social media platform. How does this case come about? What is the sort of the legal basis? What are the Supreme Court justices wrestling with just this past Tuesday? The suit takes aim at a federal law. You probably have heard about this because it's somewhat been out there. It's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, passed way back in 1996. Doesn't sound that long ago to me, but actually at the genesis, the beginnings of what we know as social media platforms today. The Section 230 Act, the Communications Decency Act. And what does it say? It shields online platforms like Google, like Facebook, like Instagram, like YouTube, from lawsuits over content that is posted by their users or for their decisions that they may decide, those platform providers, to take content down. Let me say that again. Section 230 Communications Decency Act provision shields, prevents the imposition of liability, civil liability, for content posted by their users or the decision to take that content down. The case gives the Supreme Court justices this opportunity to determine whether or not that shield should be applied, gutted in its entirety, potentially opening up companies to liability. Right after this break, we'll talk more about the implications of Gonzalez versus Google, and we'll talk specifically about how the Supreme Court justices articulated their initial views about this when we come back. Stay with us for that.
Light the lamp.
All the way down, he scores! A 200-foot empty net goal for the captain.
And defend the ice.
Driving in, centering pass. Oh, great sliding left pad save.
This is America's college hockey capital.
Fire one towards the net and scores.
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger hockey.
Right here on WFHR, locally grown radio, your home for Wisconsin sports.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
Medicaid and CHIP offer free or low-cost health coverage for children and teens. Hospital and doctor visits, prescriptions, shots, and more are covered. That's peace of mind for parents if a child is sick or gets injured. And parents may now be eligible for Medicaid, too, even if they've applied in the past. Enrollment is always open. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
From the home of the Cranberry Blossom Festival, your news talk and sports station is locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Bringing some sanity to the airwaves, the Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
Welcome back to our continuing discussion this morning of all things Supreme Court. Over the break, talking about this case called Gonzalez versus Google. The justices hearing this past week, this case challenging Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, decades old, that protects places and platforms like Google, Facebook, and others from lawsuits over what their users, including you and me, might post online. Again, this case coming out of the horrific death of Naomi Gonzalez in the horrific Paris attacks of November 2015, credited to and accepted responsibility for by ISIS. And so the question here, whether or not, indeed, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act remains this shield, or should the Supreme Court take a look at that law and find that it should be rolled back in one way or another? Critics of Section 230 say that it lets the tech companies avoid responsibility, plainly, for these kinds of harms that are alleged by the family of Naomi Gonzalez, and further facilitates this kind of activity, potentially to the harm of many people out there. Supporters, of course, counter that without that legal shield, these companies, these tech companies, will take down more content than ever to avoid lawsuits, potentially compromising this notion of freedom of speech and freedom of expression that we have come to understand the social media platforms to be all about. And the Supreme Court, again, wrestling with this issue about the extent to which social media platforms are responsible for what their users post online. An argument of just this past week, fascinating in many, many ways. A sprawling argument lasting almost 3 hours before the United States Supreme Court. The justices seem to view the positions in both directions as too extreme. Either side too extreme, giving them on the one hand, again, this choice between exposing these search engines, these online platform providers, and Twitter with liability on the one hand, and protecting algorithms and other mechanisms that seem to promote this pro-ISIS or other incendiary content on the other. And so not a happy choice to make. At the same time, interestingly, the Supreme Court justices seem to express doubt about their own competence to find some middle ground, which they often try to do. The Supreme Court Chief Justice himself, Elena Kagan, who we're going to hear from a lot in these cases and future cases, said, you know, these are not like the 9 greatest experts on the internet. And that prompted laughter within the Supreme Court courtroom this past Tuesday. Other justices, as a very practical concerns, Brett Kavanaugh, echoing comments made in some of the briefs the written documents submitted by the parties in favor and opposition to the proposals of the parties in these cases. He worried out loud that a decision imposing limits on the shield, imposing a limit on this Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, would, as he said, really crash the digital economy with all sorts of effects on workers and consumers, retirement plans, and what have you. So he's concerned about the impact upon restricting Section 230. Drawing lines in this area, he said, was a job for Congress. There you have it. Often repeated by the Supreme Court. We shouldn't be involved in this. The legislature asked to act. We are not equipped to account for that, Kavanaugh said. The case comes, of course, as these cutting-edge events happen, not only involving Noemi Gonzalez, her horrific death, but also other implications of things posted of an incendiary nature, a violent nature, an indoctrinating nation. Justice Kagan said that this was a pre-algorithm statute. She said the statute basically is outdated. It provided scant guidance, she said, in a post-algorithm world. Neil Gorsuch also voicing his views on this during the course of the oral arguments of the past Tuesday. He marveled from the bench at the advances in artificial intelligence. He said artificial intelligence generates poetry. It generates polemics. So we got all this sort of academic musings on what AI is all about and the implications of this decision. Again, very important. Other justices also weighed in. Justice Clarence Thomas said that recommendations were vital to make internet platforms more useful. He said this: if you're interested in cooking, you don't want thumbnails on light jazz. Again, talking about the applications of algorithms and the access to various things on the internet. He later added, I see these as suggestions and not really recommendations because they don't really comment on them. Again, a lot of pronouns there. He's talking basically about trying to find different solutions to these problems. Kagan went on to say, I can imagine a world where you're right, that none of this stuff gets protection. And, you know, every other industry has to internalize the costs of its conduct. She went on to say, why is it that the tech industry gets a pass? A little bit unclear. On the other hand, Kagan went on to say, I mean, we're a court. We really don't know about these things. Again, indicating that these nine justices may not be, as she said, the greatest experts on the internet. Sam Alito said he was lost. He said, I'm lost on this. I don't know where you're drawing the line, he told one of the advocates in front of him. That's the problem. The provision, again, Section 230 says this: no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by any other information content provider. That provision, of course, helped to promote the rise, the very rise, the increase, the development of places like Facebook, social networks like Twitter, others, ensuring that these sites did not and do not assume legal liability for every post. The issue here, again, is whether or not that fundamental principle set forth in Section 230, whether that continues or not. A ruling against Google would either force the sites to take down some content, presumably that was remotely problematic, maybe allow no content at all. But again, other arguments on the other side about this, about the impact of these kinds of things posted on social media, Supreme Court wrestling with that this past week. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other case, also argued, much related, in this same area on Wednesday, a case called Twitter versus Tomney. Stay tuned for that discussion as well.
News talk and sports on both sides of the dial from Wisconsin Rapids and beyond. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
I'm William Shatner. I've been around a long time, but I'm truly humbled when I see the real battles our brave, paralyzed veterans have faced defending our freedom.
I was on a routine patrol, and we were in the desert of Kuwait, and the vehicle flipped and landed on top of me, which left me paralyzed from the waist down.
Okay, folks, this is heroism. That's why I'm proud to support Paralyzed Veterans of America. Go to PVA.org to learn how you can make a difference.
The sun's shining, birds are singing, and all feels right in the world.
Until the season changes, and suddenly you lose your motivation to get out of bed. In fact, 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the season or time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all, because we want you to live your best life and be your best you all year round.
Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go. I didn't think I'd survive. But I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there.
Covenant House helped me break the cycle of homelessness in my family. They gave me the love that I needed.
Over 2,000 young people will sleep safely in a Covenant House bed tonight. When youth who are experiencing homelessness have a hot meal, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love, they can overcome heartbreaking challenges and have a brighter future.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding. I'm a speaker, I'm an author. Covenant House really helped me and really helped mold me into the woman I am today.
If you or someone you love is asking for help, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Meet Ingrid, fiery spirit, caring grandma, proud trucker.
I've logged more than 4 million miles in my truck. If people knew what I know, lives could be saved. I was driving outside of Ohio when a gentleman stopped suddenly in front of me. But it takes my 80,000-pound truck 200 yards to stop. I'd given myself extra room, but it's not a chance worth taking.
It's our roads. It's our safety.
Visit www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's matchingdonors.com. Matchingdonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 22 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit matchingdonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life. Matchingdonors.com.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Partly cloudy skies this afternoon with daytime highs approaching 30. Southwesterly winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Partly cloudy skies again tonight. Lows dip down to about 12. Mainly sunny skies and calm tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 34. About an inch of snow Monday through Monday night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 18.
Wait a minute. How about this? Listen to me, you lantern-jawed cretin, you horned-eyed homunculus. You are going to do what's right for the people of Wisconsin. You're putting cancer water in our water, destroying the greatest university system in the country and public education. Knock it off. That is unlikely to be said. That's what I'd say.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct.
Continuing this morning, our discussion of the United States Supreme Court and these fascinating and potentially very, very important decisions of the United States Supreme Court when it comes to online platforms, groups like Google and Twitter, Facebook, and others that provide opportunities for, yes, communication and discussion under the First Amendment, but also provide platforms for groups like ISIS or ISIL to present incendiary, indoctrinating misinformation that may ultimately result in horrific results. We talked about the implications of that with respect to the case called Gonzalez versus Google, Noemi Gonzalez, this 23-year-old California student horrifically murdered in the Paris melee back in November of 2015. And the oral argument before the Supreme Court this past Tuesday of her family that under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, they, in fact, should be permitted to go ahead with their civil lawsuit against Google for permitting the posting of these incendiary, indoctrinating messages that prompted ISIL or its actors effectively to kill their daughter. Fascinating, horrific question, but fascinating question at the same time, and potentially affecting the future of the internet. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard another case. Sounds an awful lot like the Gonzalez case, but slightly different in terms of its predicates. This case, Twitter versus Tamneh, T-A-A-M-N-E-H. How does this one come about? Well, this case concerns an individual named Nauras Alassaf, A-L-A-S-S-A-F. He, like Noemi Gonzalez, was also killed in a terrorist attack, but in a different place. He was killed in a terrorist attack in a nightclub in Istanbul in 2017. And ISIS, the Islamic State, once again claimed responsibility for that attack that resulted in Mr. Alassaf's death. His family, like the Gonzalez family, in the other case, sued Twitter and some other tech companies as well. And in that lawsuit, that civil complaint, they said that the Twitter executives had effectively allowed ISIS to use their platform to recruit and train terrorists. That's the basis for this lawsuit. And the Supreme Court again heard oral arguments this past Wednesday on this question of whether internet platforms may be sued for, here we go, aiding and abetting international terrorism by failing to remove videos supporting the Islamic State. Now, the case, again, just like the other one, concerns a federal law. This one a little bit different, but again, much related. This federal law allows suits for knowingly providing substantial assistance to terrorists. And again, it's linked to the other case on Tuesday. But this one is different because, unlike the Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is the Gonzalez predicate, this one is premised upon the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act. And again, it allows civil lawsuits for parties under many conditions, other circumstances, for knowingly providing substantial assistance to terrorists, plainly that results in damages or injuries. And again, the family of Nauras Alassaf maintaining that's exactly what Twitter did by providing ISIS with this opportunity, this platform to indoctrinate people that resulted in this horrific terrorist attack that resulted in the death of their son, Nauras. The question again before the Supreme Court is whether or not that is a legitimate cause of action under the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act. Interestingly, fascinating oral argument once again. Lawyer for Twitter stressed that the plaintiffs, again, the family of Mr. Alassaf, had not accused his client of providing substantial assistance, much less knowing substantial assistance for that attack. So he draws this line between substantial assistance directly provided, adding that it was undisputed that Twitter had no intent, again, that word intent that we talked about previously, to aid terrorist activities as a part of their regular operation. The attorney went on to say, what we have here is an alleged failure to do more to ferret out violations of clear and enforced policy against assisting or allowing any postings supporting terrorist organizations. So what did the Supreme Court justices say about all that? Well, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, once again weighing in this, told that attorney that the fact remains that you knew that ISIS was using your platform. Those words from Justice Sotomayor. Brett Kavanaugh once again weighed in on Twitter's position. He said whether there's a legitimate business that provides services on a widely available basis in an arm's length manner, it's not going to be liable under this statute, even if it knows bad people use its service for bad things. In other words, tipping his hand that he will probably support Twitter in this. Kagan went on to say, that is the platform providers, provide 100 other clients who are not terrorists with the same kinds of banking services, drawing this analogy between financial institutions. But they provide this known terrorist with these banking services that are very important to its terrorist activities. Can you go after that person under this statute? The attorney, again, for the family said yes. You can go after the customer as long as somebody was a leader or somebody who you know has committed or is about to commit a terrorist act is, in fact, involved in the lawsuit. Justice Kagan came back and said, well, maybe that banking and social media are not that different. Went on to say, we're used to thinking about banks as providing very important services to terrorists. maybe we're not so used to, but it seems to be true that various kinds of social media platforms also provide very important services. Amy Coney Barrett suggested the decision in favor of Twitter on this this case in the Wednesday's case could effectively resolve both disputes, the Google case and also the Twitter case. And we will see. We will see what happens in these cases now pending in front of the United States Supreme Court, no less the importance of the future of the Internet, whether or not providers of platform services, including providers under the First Amendment, can be held liable, and the impact of that, if indeed they can be held liable, whether it's under the Terrorist Act, the Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or the more omnibus act involving the Communications Decency Act and Section 230. We will wait to see what the Supreme Court says about all of that. Probably a mixed result, again, among the justices. No clarity from the oral arguments of Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. Clarity coming up probably in May or June on these all-important oral arguments. We have got a caller who's calling in. Tom from St. Paul, thanks for staying on the line. Your comment or question this morning on our broadcast.
You have a lot to talk about, but I'm talking about the Colorado case.
Yes.
Where the jury is going to be re-instructed about applying the death penalty.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if the Supreme Court could take the extremely wise route of abolishing the death penalty altogether, because it is at cross purposes with the Declaration of Independence aims to that we're all equal and to secure life and liberty. So employing the death penalty just totally throws life and liberty out the window. And instead, they could contract with Cuba, the individual states could contract with Cuba to send people to Gitmo in exile. And we could pay Cuba for taking care of the people for the rest of their lives in exile.
Well, that's a good thoughts there, Tom. Lots to unpack there. I'm going to address just the first portion of that because you've whether it's stumbled upon or identified purposely, a major part of the Supreme Court jurisprudence has to do with the Eighth Amendment that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. That's what you're really talking about in the Constitution when you say that it should be prohibited. You should know that to this day, there is, of course, a huge dispute out there about whether or not the Eighth Amendment that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment does, in fact, prohibit or permit the death penalty in America. The Supreme Court, up till this time, has not adopted your particular view, but nonetheless said that it is not a cruel and unusual punishment to impose the death penalty as long as a number of prerequisites, procedures, processes are in place for review and analysis. And that is the state of the law today. That is not to say, Tom, that the Supreme Court could not reverse that position. There have been Supreme Court justices, and presumably we've got at least three of them on the Supreme Court right now, who would take the very view that you're articulating as well, that the Eighth Amendment does prohibit the death penalty, and that this years-long, decades-long position should be overturned, and that under the Eighth Amendment, the death penalty should be prohibited. That's the kind of thing that, that's why it depends so dramatically upon who is on the Supreme Court. The issue that you've raised about the implications, not only of this Cruz case, but more broadly, about whether or not under our Constitution we should be putting anyone to death is one that the Supreme Court has wrestled with up to this time, has said you can do it as long as states, and again, here in Wisconsin, we do not have the death penalty. Other places plainly do. Arizona, obviously, Texas, many other states. Whether you do that is a decision of the state legislature, as long as there are sufficient safeguards in place to ensure due process, equal protection, all kinds of things to ensure that we do this most dramatic thing that a government can do in terms of doling out some sense of justice in America. Very important point. Other issues related to other alternatives out there, those are the kinds of things that are a part of the debate, Tom. So very much appreciate your comments and your questions about that. very important. We'll stay on top of that as more death penalty cases certainly come before the Supreme Court, maybe not in this term, but in future terms as well. Got other callers on the line. Jake, I'm calling also about our program, presumably this morning, your comment or question for us.
Yeah, I just to say that I think companies like Facebook and Twitter should no longer be allowed to have it both ways. You know, they want to say there should be no legal liability because they're not publishers, so they're not to be held accountable for whatever kind of incendiary thing that may be put on their platform that leads to, you know, someone's death. But then they want to say they're not utilities. And they spent billions of dollars over the years convincing people around the world that, in fact, these things like Facebook and Twitter and other social media sites are necessary to a quality life. And you have, you know, many Americans who agree with that. You know, basically anyone under 40, try to tell them no social media for you. And right. Yeah, they would probably agree that they're utilities at this point and should be regulated as such. For instance, Twitter as a utility should have never been allowed to be sold to an egomaniac like Elon Musk. So at this point, they got to choose. Are they publishers or are they utilities?
Right. Right. And Jake, you should know, again, you should be at the Supreme Court, perhaps. That's exactly what some of the justices were concerned about. What is the nature of this kind of communication platform, and what is their status? Are they simply public avenues for general expression under the First Amendment, or do they provide a service? And depending upon how you define what they do, if they're a utility, can they be regulated, and how should we regulate them? Your point, I think, very well taken. Some self-definition has to happen here. The Supreme Court also this past week plainly sending the message that, gosh, the questions you've raised, Jake, other things out there, kind of beyond their expertise and scratching their head when Justice Alito says, you know what, I'm kind of lost. And Justice Kagan says we're not especially equipped to do these kinds of things, underscores the difficulty of wrestling with 21st century technology using, again, statutes passed in the 20th century. Great comments by all those comments, Jake. Appreciate your calling in as well. We also have Rico on the line calling in. Rico, we appreciate your comment or question.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for doing the show this morning. Hey, absolutely. It's kind of this question I got kind of ties into this whole wheelhouse of the social media. Jim, came up earlier this week, and I'd like for you to explain maybe just the fundamentals and the boundaries of something that was referred to as the Hatch Act.
Yes.
And how might today's social media platforms and internet play into that? And thanks, Jim, man. I'll take your answer off air.
Sure, Rico. Good comment. I'll be brief here because we're almost going into a break. But to take your comment, Hatch Act has to do with the prohibition on government officials from engaging in politics. Can't advocate for campaigns every so often. We've got government officials who do run afoul of that. And the Hatch Act plainly is a public prohibition on that kind of activity. We'll talk more about that and other things when we come back from this break. And we're going to talk more about some of the Supreme Court other decisions in the past right after this brief break.
The moment you walk into Family Natural Foods, you know you'll have a great experience with excellent customer service. Their knowledgeable staff are welcoming and friendly, happy to help you with any questions or needs you bring in. Have you tried their oils and vinegars yet? You can taste test them before you buy. Some favorites among the gourmet balsamic vinegars include cranberry, date, and apple. Think beyond the salad bowl. These are great on everything from veggies to grilled meats. Family Natural Foods, 910 West Grand Avenue.
Mornings were made for better things than rheumatoid arthritis or RA. Xeljanz tofacitinib is a pill for adults with moderate to severe RA when tumor necrosis factor blockers did not work well or could not be tolerated. Xeljanz can help relieve joint pain, swelling, and help stop further joint damage. Xeljanz can lower your ability to fight infections. Don't start if you have one. Before and during treatment, your doctor should check for infections like TB and do blood tests. Serious, sometimes fatal infections, cancers including lymphoma and lung, blood clots, serious heart-related events, tears in the stomach or intestines, and allergic reactions have happened. People 50 and older with heart disease risk factors have an increased risk of death. Tell your doctor if you've had hepatitis B or C, have flu-like symptoms, are prone to infections, or have ever had a heart attack, stroke, clot, or other heart problems, or swelling of lips, tongue, throat, or hives.
Ask your doctor about prescription Xeljanz. Visit Xeljanz.com or call 1-844-XELJANZ.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous Ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app. Your place for this area's news, talk, and sports. We are locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
Fields Choice for News Talk Radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Back for our final minutes, our final moments together, talking about all things Supreme Court right before the break. Rico had called in with this question about the Hatch Act and the interaction between it and social media providers and the public in general. Hatch Act, as I said, this prohibition, lots and lots of different aspects to it, for the most part, prohibits people in government. In government from crossing over the line from their official capacities to endorsing, promoting, otherwise advancing political candidacies. And so every so often you will see someone who gets a little bit of trouble if, in fact, in a public and an official capacity, they are endorsing or somehow approving or someone encouraging voting for a particular candidate, otherwise advocating for the election of someone. And this is the reason why, Rico and others, for example, you do not see on the campaign trail this year and next year, members of the cabinet of the president out there campaigning along with him, advocating for his reelection or the election of anyone out there. Just once again, because government in terms of its integrity and its purpose should not be promoting a particular candidacy. That's for the private sector, if you will, to do. That's for Americans generally to be making decisions on, not using the trappings and the offices of official offices to promote candidacies. Plainly implicated by the public forums that that places like Twitter and platforms like Google, others provide, can in fact be promoted and be accomplished privately by individuals. But if you're a public official, generally the recommendation is to stay away from anything like that. Doesn't mean you can't vote. Doesn't mean you can't have your private views, but not just in the public domain, whether it's spoken or also on a public platform like Google, Twitter, and others, Facebook, and so forth. So appreciate the question tremendously, Rico. In our final moments of this broadcast, we're going to begin what I promised at the outset, which is going to continue in the second of our three series of discussions about the Supreme Court. I promised before that we'd be talking every single session over the course of these three about a couple of cases that have dramatically impacted life and livelihood in America. And we're going to begin in these last moments, going to continue this next Saturday in talking about firearms in America. We've had callers in recent broadcasts who've talked about the onslaught, the crisis, the challenge presented by firearms in America. We know that just in this past year alone, in places like Enoch, Utah, Goshen, California, Monterey Bay, California, Half Moon Bay, California, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., East Lansing, Tate County, Mississippi, plainly Memphis, and yes, just this past week, Orlando, we continue to suffer as a nation from problems with huge challenges presented by guns in America. What does the Second Amendment say about all that? And what has the Supreme Court said about it as well? Well, we know that from a recent decision, which we're going to get to next time, Supreme Court, just this past June, in a case called Bruin, said that in order to support restrictions and controls and other rules and regulations, those rules and regulations imposed by state legislatures, by local bodies, have to be consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation. That's the present standard. We're going to get back to that next broadcast as we talk more about what Bruin means. But today, going to begin to talk about the nature of this problem. A group called the Gun Violence Archive, a legitimate, nonpartisan, apolitical entity, a nonprofit research group that examines and provides information about gun violence in America, has established that by mid-February of this year alone, we've had 80 mass shootings in America, seven of those involving four or more fatalities. What is a mass shooting? Some disagreement out there about the definition of that, but for the most part, a mass shooting understood to be a situation where four or more people are shot. Could be killed, could be injured, four or more people are shot. 80 of those mass shootings in America up to this point in our calendar year. Last year, 647 mass shootings in America, 21 of those involving five or more fatalities in 2022. Again, we have a challenge in America. We have deaths in America. And the question is, and the question posed to the Supreme Court almost 15 years ago, and again just last year, is what do we do about that? And what does the Second Amendment say and mean when it comes to firearms in America? Let's start this discussion knowing we will anticipate more of this at the start of our next broadcast. What does the Second Amendment say? It says this: a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That is the Second Amendment to the Constitution. That's all it says. It was proposed by the first Congress in 1789, again, shortly after the Judiciary Act of that year, ratified by the states in 1791. And again, by way of introduction, for over 200 years, that language, the Second Amendment, has not been interpreted by the courts, including the United States Supreme Court, to vest, to establish a constitutional right in any individual to firearm ownership and use. Let me say that again. For most of our nation's history, that language in the Second Amendment has not been interpreted by the courts, lower courts, the district courts, the federal courts, at the appellate level, at the Supreme Court level, to establish a constitutional right in any one individual to firearm ownership and use. In fact, on four occasions in our history, the Supreme Court explicitly rejected that Constitution and application of the Constitution itself. And so that brings us to recent history, including 2008 and then again 2022. And that's the focus of what we're going to begin right now and continue in the second of our three-part series on the Constitution, plainly addressing firearms in America. Let me tease it by saying this. In 1975, based on reports and findings of widespread gun violence, domestic violence, public gun violence, the District of Columbia, the legislature there, enacted legislation that banned residents from owning handguns and mandating that they be stored disassembled in their homes. And that legislation in 1975, coming out of the District of Columbia, resulted in a case called Heller. Heller versus District of Columbia, decided by a majority of the Supreme Court in 2008, in which Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for the majority, said this: the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to possess a gun unrelated to service in a militia, and to employ that weapon for traditionally lawful purposes, such as self-defense in the home. Next time, and in our future broadcast, we're going to talk more about that case, Heller. We're going to talk more about Bruin, the Second Amendment, and the importance of all these cases for our lives and our livelihoods in the United States of America, for all of us in our times that we live. Thank you for joining us this day. Join us again next week for that continuing discussion of our United States Supreme Court. Have a good week, everybody.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you
WFHR,
by AARP,
Wisconsin Council. Rapids, 1320 AM and W248 DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.